Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. Across vast swaths of North Korea, political prisoners live their entire miserable lives in concentration camps, where during numbing hours of forced labor, they're beaten, starved, raped, and often killed. The ones who somehow survive are often dead of disease brought on by severe malnutrition by their 40s or 50s, without ever seeing the outside world, let alone Pyongyang. Prisoners are debased and dehumanized. They do not understand love or forgiveness, and survive only by turning on one another. Much of what we know about the lives of the estimated 200,000 such prisoners is thanks to defectors who escaped the camps to China, South Korea, and the U.S. But there is only believed to be one refugee who was born into the camps to escape, Shin Dong-hyuk, who spent more than 2 decades in Camp 14 before dreams of a full stomach inspired his risky flight. The story is told in the riveting book Escape from Camp 14, One Man's Remarkable Odyssey from North Korea to Freedom in the West, which is written by acclaimed journalist Blaine Hardin and published by Viking. Blaine Hardin, welcome to the Roundtable.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
Why exactly are these families locked in these camps, according to the North Koreans?
The camps really are a tool that North Korea uses to control the population. It's a totalitarian state, and it's the last surviving state, such state. It's also the longest lasting totalitarian state in world history. And the camps are sort of a classic tool of a totalitarian government to lock up, put away, neutralize, eliminate perceived political enemies, but also to scare the hell out of everybody else in the country so that they behave in a docile way. And to that end, the camps have worked rather well for North Korea.
There's a sense of wonder in your book that this regime has not collapsed owing to the hunger and the amount of people who are trickling into China and the fact that these camps are becoming more and more well known. How do you explain that the grip on power has not been lost yet?
Well, I think there's two explanations, and one is simply one word, China. China continues to be a patron for North Korea, providing fuel, food, and goods at reduced prices or sometimes for free. And it also buys a lot of North Korea's raw materials. It has iron ore, coal, and some other minerals that are of use to China in its booming manufacturing sector. So China also wants a buffer between itself and a U.S.-oriented South Korea. So it helps prop up North Korea. And I think without China's help, North Korea would not be long for this world. But the other reason why the state survives, its economy is a ruin, but it survives as a totalitarian state because the government is very willing to continue to do the things that totalitarian states usually lose their stomach for, which is cruelty to their own people and almost complete isolation. People there cannot travel freely to other countries. They have a very hard time getting information about the outside world, although that curtain is fraying because of technology. But they also, the camps are very much alive and functioning to scare people, as is the secret police apparatus. And I think that's why North Korea continues to persist.
So as I understand it, at the outset of the Civil War, and the separation into North and South Korea, Kim Il-sung promised that 3 generations of anyone's family and even distant relatives who went against the North would be cleansed before being allowed back into society. So has that promise or rule been kept to?
Yes, it seems that collective or that you know punishment by being related to a perceived wrongdoer continues in North Korea. It's not always the case, but in many cases, if I were to offend the regime, commit what they perceive to be a thought crime or say something critical of the regime, I would be sent to the labor camp, my children would go, and so would my parents. And there are now 5 of these camps, and the population is most recently estimated at 135 to 150,000. And one of the camps, Camp 15, also called Yodok, used to have a re-education zone. You could go to that camp and learn or memorize the teachings of the great and dear leaders and be released after 2 to 10 years along with your family. since 2009, no one's been released from Yaddock, according to defectors. And so it's really unclear what's happening, if everybody who goes there now will be sentenced for life. Certainly most of the camps operate as no-exit camps. Once you get there, you don't leave your work to death.
Let's talk about the camp in question in this book, Camp 14. How much space does it take up? What goes on there? And, you know, how many people are working there and how many people are in prison there?
The camp is located about 50 miles north of the capital, Pyongyang, in the mountains. It's about 15 miles long, 10 miles wide, and it runs along the Taedong River, which is a major river in North Korea. And it has factories for making military uniforms, for making pottery. Food is grown there. Pigs are raised there. It's in many ways a self-contained little village. Shin Dong-hyuk, the hero of my book, he said the only thing that he saw regularly brought into the camp was salt. The prisoners grew the food that they ate. Their meals are interestingly simple and monotonous and not very nutritious. It was the same meal, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, for 23 years for Shin. It was corn and cabbage soup with salt.
Let's talk about Shin. He was born to parents he sort of barely knew and didn't feel anything for his mother. How much of the breakdown of the family unit is to credit, I guess, for the way the camp holds power over its people?
Well, the news that Shin brings about the camps is that there are reward marriages inside some of these no-exit camps, where people in their early 20s are actually selected by the guards and encouraged to breed. And Shin was the result of such a union, and he was basically bred to be farm labor or to be slave labor in the camp. So that is something new that Shin's life discloses about the camp. And the result of that kind of family structure, if you want to call it a family, is that Shin had a strange competitive relationship with his mother and father and brother. He basically saw them as rivals who could take food from him. And that's the way he grew up. He very often stole his mother's lunch if he could. She would beat him, but he thought that having food in his stomach was preferable. He was willing to put up with the beatings as long as he could eat her food. And his relationship with her remained strained throughout her life. And she was executed in the camp when he was 13.
It's amazing to read this book because, you know, you can't sit in judgment of what anyone under these circumstances has done. However, there was a moment where you found out a deeper truth than Shin was originally telling. Tell us about that.
When Shin arrived in South Korea towards the end of 2006, about a year and a half after he managed to escape the camp, all arriving North Koreans in South Korea are interrogated by intelligence officials in South Korea because they want to know what's going on in North Korea and they want to weed out infiltrators from the North, people who are sent as spies and sometimes as assassins. In any case, Shin had conversations with them, and then he had conversations with human rights people and with the people who helped him adjust to life in South Korea. And he told about the death of his mother and brother, how they were executed. What he did not say, and what he told no one until about a year and a half into his interviews with me for the book, is that when he was 13 years old, he was at his mother's room one night when he heard her and his brother mention the word escape. He had been raised with the rules of the camp, the Ten Commandments, as he called them. The first commandment being, if you try to escape, you will be shot immediately. And the second rule is, if you learn about an escape and fail to report it, you will be shot immediately. So when he heard that about his mother and brother, he got up out of the house, told his mom he had to go to the bathroom, and went and told a guard. The result of that was that his mother and brother were immediately taken to an underground prison inside the camp, where they were held for 7 months. But the guard that Shin told, that he snitched to, did not disclose to his superiors that Shin had been the snitch. So Shin was also taken to that underground prison for 7 months. He didn't know his mother and brother and father were also there. And Shin was tortured during that time. But he was released and then was allowed or forced to watch the hanging of his mother and the execution of his brother. In any case, when Chin, it was actually 11 and a half years later, made it to South Korea, he felt that if he said that he was the one responsible for their deaths, that he might be arrested by the South Korean authorities, and if that didn't happen, he felt that he would be shunned and thought of as less than human by people that he met. So he just basically closed his heart around that experience of when he was 13 years old. He told me in the summer of 2010, because he was surrounded at that time by people he trusted who were kind to him, and that he was beginning to love people from a group called Liberty in North Korea, a human rights group. And he said, I just have to get this off. I have to tell the truth to you and to the people who care about me, because it's beginning to torment me. And he did not feel guilty about it until he got out and he learned what human relation should be, what a mother's relationship should be to her son. And he became deeply ashamed of the kind of son he had once been.
Mm. Just awful. If there could be one sort of upside of that imprisonment for the 7 months, is that he really first started to formulate the idea of what life outside the camps could be like, thanks to his relationship with a fellow prisoner.
There was an older prisoner that he called Uncle who helped nurse him in that underground prison. He had some infected burn wounds and from torture. And that prisoner shared food with him, treated him with kindness, did not expect anything in return. And that kind of treatment was for Shin utterly new, and it touched him. The man that he called Uncle also talked a bit about what it was like to eat outside the barbed wire, that you could have a proper meal of meat, of fish, you know, and really, really be comfortable, eat full. And Chin was very interested in that. 10 years later, he met a newcomer to the camp, a man named Park, who had traveled widely, not only in North Korea, but around the world. He'd been educated in the former Soviet Union before he ran afoul of the government in Pyongyang and was sent to Camp 14. In any case, Park gave Chin a two-month lecture in a primer on planet Earth, basically told him that the world was round, that China existed, that South Korea existed, and that if you got out, you could go to China and go into a restaurant and eat all the grilled meat you want. And Shin was intrigued by this. It inflamed his imagination. And within a few weeks, he asked Park if they could escape together.
Now, I won't spoil all of the details of that escape, but it's just a really scintillating story and terrifying. Here's the question, though. Is it that the odds were so long against the physical escape, or that the prisoners have been beaten down so severely and restricted that they don't even think of escaping? As you mentioned, those Ten Commandments, all of which ending with, you know, you will be shot. Are people even trying this? Because as we know, Shin's the only one who's made it out.
I think it's a combination of both. People's aspirations, their horizon is so low. It's intended to make them docile, to make them like farm animals. That seems to be the point of raising children in the camps to be slaves, is they have no aspirations for anything else. When Shin was first asked by Park, "Where are you from?" Shin said, "I'm from here. You know, this is my home." And Shin never really thought of the place as an abhorrent cage until he learned from Park that there was an outside world. And then the second part is just luck. Shin is tough, he's smart, he's resilient, he's cunning, but he was also incredibly lucky to get through the fence and get across North Korea and across the border without being arrested. He was lucky, but his escape also shows one thing that is not well understood, is that the economy of North Korea is an utter and complete mess, and that at the low level, the way people buy food and buy goods is through a scruffy, informal system of street markets, open-air markets that are in most towns and cities of North Korea. The North Korean government does not like them, but it tolerates them because they are the delivery vehicle for most of the food that people eat. It's basically the economy of North Korea by default. And also the North Korean government extracts rents in the form of bribes from merchants of all kinds, including border guards. Border guards are quite willing to allow people to cross sometimes if they'll give them money, cigarettes, or cookies. And that's what Shin did. He stole some food from a house, sold it in a market, got some cash, bought some cigarettes and cookies, and used it for the petty bribery that got him across the border.
He didn't have a good relationship with his father, understandably. Saw him a few times a year. I think they only had a couple days off where they were allowed to visit. Didn't really know him. But he assumed and took the understanding that in escaping, he was probably dooming his father. Is there any way to know if that ended up befalling his father?
No, there's no way. North Korea denies that the camp exists. Although, if you have a smartphone or a laptop, you can go to Google Earth after listening to this and find Camp 14 and find very, very clear pictures of the camp that Shin has annotated. So Shin had a final dinner with his father a day before he escaped on January 2nd, 2005. And he met with his father in part, you know, to see him one last time. But he did not tell his father that he was going to escape. He did not tell him for two reasons. One, he didn't want his father to know, because he knew that his father would be interrogated and perhaps tortured, and he didn't want his father to be in a position of lying. But he also didn't trust his father. He didn't trust his father to not turn him in. So he didn't tell his father. He assumes that his father was arrested, taken back to the underground place, tortured, and perhaps killed as a result of his escape. Shin did not feel particularly guilty about that until he has come to feel guilt about many of the ways he behaved in the camp. And now it torments him, actually.
How is he doing?
He's doing extremely well in the past year, particularly. He was living in the United States for 2 years, and in the middle of 2011, he decided to go back to Seoul. And there he's begun webcasting with other defectors for the growing defector population in South Korea, mostly clustered around Seoul. And he talks to these people on the web and posts it on YouTube about life in South Korea, about their situation in the North. And he's become poised, more emotionally balanced, and more self-confident as a person. We have been promoting the book together in the United States, and tomorrow we head to Europe to do the same. And he has been impressive, just remarkably impressive in his talks about the book and about what's going on in North Korea.
Does he foresee a day when he can visit a united Korea?
Well, you know, I think that all North Koreans very much look forward to that day. But, you know, he's a pretty realistic person. He doesn't see it happening anytime soon. He was willing to put up with the misery of talking to me about his embarrassing past. And he put up with it for 2 years because he wants people to become aware and to put pressure on particularly the United States government to make human rights a big part of the conversation with China about North Korea. And at the beginning of this conversation, we talked about China's leverage. You know, China could, if it wanted to, put pressure on North Korea and perhaps close the camps. It's unlikely it would do so, but right now nobody even talks to them about it. So that's the hope.
Well, I have to say, anyone who reads this book will sort of share in that optimism. The name of the book is Escape from Camp 14, One Man's Remarkable Odyssey from North Korea to Freedom in the West. We've been speaking with journalist Blaine Hardin. The book is published by Viking. Blaine, thank you so much for telling us this story. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.